It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll take a look at some of the big court cases of the last year here in Wisconsin.
First, there is plenty of debate in the education world over the merits of lecturing. Critics say it's an outdated method of teaching, but supporters say it works.
But our next guest says the debate over lecturing is missing the main point. Rather than dismissing or embracing any teaching method, educators should focus on the best way to teach a particular skill, whether that's lecturing or something else.
We're joined now by Paul Cargan. He is an assistant professor of English at Southeastern University, and he blogs at Teaching and Learning in Higher Ed. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you bet. It's an interesting topic. I was reminded back when I was in college that some of the lectures I heard were the best professors I ever had, and some of the lectures I heard were from the worst professors I ever had. So it was a real mix there. And in your piece, the piece I read, I didn't know, I have to say, that there was this big internal debate going on in the education world about the merits of lecturing. For those of us who are not involved in education on a day-to-day basis, could you kind of outline the two sides for us?
Yeah, I sure can. And I'll say the debate happens in a perhaps an unusual way. We don't stand in the university hallways shouting at one another. Instead, we write about it online, and then we kind of have our opinions, and then we'll discuss it at times. Academic debates often happen more civilly than political debates, but there are a lot of strong feelings about it. So the lecturing is, of course, the traditional method in which college classes are taught. You see it in films quite a bit. Students come in, they sit down, and the professor stands up at the front of the room and talks. And as you said, based on your experience, a lot of people have similar experience. Sometimes that is engaging and interesting. Sometimes you learn quite a bit, and sometimes you don't. And there are other ways to teach as well. And so some of those who have discovered or returned to some of these other methods, whether discussion or the Socratic method or project-based learning, lots of different approaches, say we ought to get rid of lecturing. There's no place for it. And others feel no way. We've been doing this for a long time. We like it. Some of the students like it. We think it works. So we're going to keep going at it. So those are the sides of the debate that happen. And you'll see from time to time articles online or in professional journals kind of staking out a side.
So are these being presented as sort of an either-or, either you lecture or you don't argument?
Well, I think that is often what happens, and that's not helpful, is my argument. And it's not just my argument. A lot of folks feel similarly.
So you've written that supporters of lecturing rarely advocate only lecturing. In other words, it's just sort of one tool in the toolbox. And meanwhile, supporters of alternative ways of teaching rarely advocate never lecturing. So lecturing has a place in there, and it sounds like you're trying to argue that it's trying to find out exactly what your purpose is, what your class is like, what your subject is. Like there's more to this debate than just whether lecturing is good or bad.
Yeah, exactly. So, like a lot of debates, the version of it that happens in public is very different from the version of it that happens kind of behind the scenes or with professionals. We see this, of course, in science debates quite a bit. The public is arguing over something that's very different than what scientists are arguing over. And so with lecturing, you'll see a lot of people say, well, I had the best professor in college, and she lectured, and these lectures inspired me, and I learned a lot. And then you'll have someone else say, I had all my professors lecture, and I learned nothing. It was horrible. I had to learn everything myself that I wanted to. And so this happens in public, on radio shows or on the internet, blogs and articles. But the debate that's going on, or the discussion that's going on in professional journals, looks very different. And we're not gonna ask kind of what method should be used outright. Is there one method that's gonna help everyone learn everything? Instead, we're gonna take a step back. We're gonna ask, What is it we want our students to learn? And that's perhaps one of the most powerful questions in teaching, is to really step back and ask about your purpose. I think teaching often happens by default. You get put in the classroom, you're given a subject, you're an expert in that subject, and you kind of do what you experienced in class. Often professors are experts in math or history or archaeology or literature, but don't necessarily take much training, study in teaching itself. And so they just kind of teach by default. And so I think one of the most powerful questions is to step back and say, what is it I want to accomplish? And lecturing has been studied quite a bit, and it's been found to be more useful for some purposes than other purposes. For example, if you wanted to teach a student to think critically about some subject, intuitively we might say, we'll give a lecture on it and we'll demonstrate some critical thinking, and that'll rub off on them. And that has not really shown to be the case. Often what lecturing will do is it'll give students information about the topic. But if our goals, our purpose in teaching is deeper than just giving information, then we want to find kind of methods that are better suited to that. And of course, it's not an either or. Sometimes we'll want to give them information. Other times we'll want to deepen their appreciation for a subject. Other times we'll want them to learn to think about it. Other times we'll want them to learn to think about it or to communicate about it. Well, the more complex we can think about the purpose, what are we trying to accomplish, the better we can kind of sort through all the available methods for teaching them.
Is there a perception, and that might be feeding into some of this, that lecturing is just old-fashioned and it's maybe outlived its usefulness?
Well, certainly. A lot of people feel that way about it. And then a lot of people feel, well, it's not old-fashioned, it's traditional. And I like to point out that it's not the oldest teaching method. Certainly when people had to learn to hunt and gather, they weren't taught by a lecture. They were taught more hands-on ways. And then, of course, the famous Socratic method, this give and take of discussion and questioning, came before the lecture as we know it, which developed in the medieval universities. So there's a sense that it's traditional or that it's old-fashioned, depending on the perspective. But to me, its age is not really the question. It's what will it do to help us do what we want to do? It's a tool in the toolbox. That phrase that you use, I think, is nice. I imagine someone asking a carpenter, well, what tool is better, a hammer or a screwdriver? And of course, it's a silly question. Because if you need to hammer something, a hammer works a lot better. And if you need to tighten a screw, a screwdriver works a lot better. And so it's the same thing in teaching. You really want to have a range of methods to be able to pick the most appropriate one on any given occasion.
All right. And in the last minute or so that we have remaining, what's your takeaway on, or what do you hope educators that might be listening to this conversation take away from it?
Oh, that's a good question. Thanks. Really, I'm all in for thinking more deeply about teaching. So there's lecture-based teaching and there's discussion-based teaching, and I'm really not a proponent or opponent of either one. But what I'm against, I'd say, is default-based teaching, teaching without putting a lot of reflection or thought into it. And I think this happens not because teachers don't care. All of the teachers, virtually all of the teachers I know, care very much about teaching and very much about their students, but not all of them have put in kind of the depth of reflection that they could benefit from. And so that's I'm always encouraging just more thoughtfulness, more reflection on teaching.
All right. Sounds like a good resolution for the new year. Paul, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Paul Carrigan has been with us, an assistant professor of English at Southeastern University.
Coming up, we'll be joined by a WPR reporter to discuss the top court cases of the past year here in Wisconsin. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up, as we celebrate the new year, we also mark the occasion in a different way by throwing away lots of stuff. We'll find out why this is peak trash season after 4:30.
First, we continue to look back at the top stories that affected our state in 2013, now with a focus on the courts in Wisconsin. WPR reporter Gilman Halstead covers legal issues in the courts. He joins us now in the studio. Gilman, welcome back to the show and happy almost New Year.
Thanks for asking me.
Well, first, we talked a little bit earlier about some of the top stories. Abortion and some laws that the legislature passed have been in the courts for a while. Give us the background on what's been going on this year.
Well, there's really one law. I was just listening to the newscast. There's some other laws that may not get ruled on coming up in the next session. But there was a law that was passed that required doctors performing abortions to not only perform,
is this about the admitting rights one?
Right, the admitting rights. But I'm trying to think of the other part of the law that actually still is in place. Ultrasounds, right. Yes. But the part of the law that was challenged has to do with requiring doctors who are performing abortions in abortion clinics to have admitting rights at hospitals within 30 miles of the clinic. And that law was enjoined right after it was passed, actually, by a federal court in Madison here. And just recently, it was that injunction was upheld by the 7th Federal Appeals Court in Chicago, which means that a trial will be scheduled. It's not been scheduled yet, but the law is still not in place, and there will be a trial on that. I mean, what's at issue there? The challenge to the law says that it basically violates the right of women to have what is a legal medical procedure by placing a burden on the doctors who are performing it. And the backers of the bill, similar laws are in place in other parts of the country, also under federal challenge. And their argument is that it's necessary to protect the medical safety of the woman so that the doctor can follow them into the hospital if there is a complication.
So when a judge or an appeals court rules on something like this and says, we don't like it, it's unconstitutional or doesn't pass muster in some way, they have a choice, right? They can say, but mine isn't the last word. It's going to be appealed. So the law is in effect until ruled otherwise.
Right.
Or, as in this case, they say, no, the law is not in effect until somebody says otherwise.
Right. Until we hear more evidence from both sides and consider all the issues that are involved in it. What's the substance of the challenge? And in other states, I believe in Texas in particular, they left the law in place, although it's still under challenge. That's not the case here. It's been enjoined. So far, it's not affecting any of the abortion clinics in Wisconsin, but it could, depending on the outcome of a trial that will be coming up in the coming year.
And supporters of the law, as you mentioned, say it's needed. It's a safety issue. But critics are saying, in effect, the outcome would be to shut down a lot of abortion providers in the state, is
right?
That right?
Two, at least, of the clinics, one in Milwaukee and one in Appleton, which would require women to travel from farther away. And because Wisconsin already has in place a law that requires a 24-hour waiting period, that would mean they would have to stay overnight somewhere, probably because they'd be coming from far away in a different part of the state, or they'd have to go to Minneapolis or Chicago, and would therefore put a burden on them. And that's what the court will decide, whether it's too big a burden for this or not.
And so this was a federal appeals court in Chicago that made the most recent ruling.
Right.
Where does it go from there?
It goes back to Madison. It goes to Judge Connolly here in Madison. He initially put that hold in place, and then the state, the Department of Justice, said, no, we should let it. They appealed that decision to enjoin the law to the Federal Appeals Court in Chicago, and the Federal Appeals Court in Chicago just ruled recently that no, that has to stay in place a trial.
And is there a timeline on when that trial might be?
No, I just was looking at the website today. It's not been scheduled.
Okay.
We would expect it to happen very soon. What's happened is that the Federal Appeals Court ruling has been sent back to Judge Connolly, and the next step will be to schedule.
so the injunction remains. It's tough talking about legal stories because I sometimes see opening lines of newspaper. The overturning of the injunction of the appeal was sustained. It's hard to tease these out.
The wheels of justice grind very slowly, Rob.
Well, and that's a good segue into the next case you've been following through the year, Act 10. What is it? It feels like it's been a decade since all that went down. It's been two years. 2 years, yeah. But that's still percolating through the courts. What have you following with Act 10?
There are currently three lawsuits still pending challenging the core of Act 10, which is whether or not restricting collective bargaining rights of public employees violates, I mean, all of them have this central to them, violates the First Amendment rights of public workers to petition the government for any reason. In this case, their salary and working conditions. The challenges are pending at different levels in the system right now. One brought by the statewide teachers union and a union representing Milwaukee City employees was heard by the Wisconsin State Supreme Court this fall, just a little more than a month ago, and we're waiting for a ruling on that. It will come sometime early in the year. One of the other two are on hold waiting for the state appeals court, and that was filed by the statewide police union. And another is on hold in the Federal District Court of Appeals in Chicago, the same one where the abortion ruling was heard, brought by city workers in Madison and the statewide AFL-CIO that represents state workers. And so the appeals court one and the one in Chicago are waiting for the state Supreme Court to rule. They've sort of agreed, let's see what the highest court in the state says about whether or not Act 10 really is constitutional, and we're all waiting tenterhooks for that one.
So, and unlike the abortion one, there was not an injunction against those corporations.
We are living under Act 10, right? Nothing has been enjoined.
And some of the weird developments over this year, and this one gets pretty complicated, but there was a possibly contempt charges against a state agency for moving forward on some of the requirements of Act 10.
Right, with elections, the certification elections, annual certification elections that are required of, because unions haven't been done away with completely, state public employee unions, but it's just limits on what they can actually bargain. And the other thing that was put in place that they had to get votes from all of the people who would be represented by the union each year. Say they wanted to be represented even to bargain wages, which is all that's left. And so the challenge which is involved actually in these cases that we are waiting for the outcome of said you can't go ahead with those because the Dane County judge who ruled in those cases said that it did apply statewide. But the decision from the state Supreme Court was that those could go ahead for right now, that the election, and they have gone ahead. And a certain number of unions have been recertified and some others haven't.
And I want to spend a couple minutes on the other issue. We're going to talk about voter ID.
Right.
And this one got pretty tangly, too. How did that progress in the courts this year?
Well, there are two cases still pending challenging the voter ID law that requires voters to have photo IDs or a good excuse why they don't before they are allowed to vote. One is in the Federal District Court in Milwaukee. Those arguments were just heard in November. And the other will be, it's actually two combined, will be argued before the state Supreme Court in February. The ACLU nationally, as well as the NAACP of Milwaukee, two different immigrant rights organizations, are arguing that the law discriminates against racial and ethnic minorities, violating the Federal Voting Rights Act. Wisconsin law was softened a little bit this fall by the legislature by allowing people to argue they don't have enough money to provide to get the required photo ID. But challengers of the law say, despite that modest change in it, that the law still places a disproportionate burden on minorities and the elderly who comprise the largest number of voters who don't have photo IDs. So backers of the law say it's needed to prevent voter fraud and protect the integrity of the vote. And rulings in these cases will probably hinge on how serious the problem of voter fraud is. Those are the arguments that were heard in Milwaukee versus the burden that the law places on people who don't have an actual photo ID.
And as it stands now, this one isn't active. We don't have to provide ID at the polls.
Right, they have been enjoined, right? It was only in place for one spring election, and the injunctions are still in place. And We'll find out next year.
And then we had the weird case here. While we're waiting to see how these are going to play out, legislators were trying to tweak the law a little to make it, in part, pass constitutional muster a little more easily.
Right. The argument there was they were hoping it would have have some kind of an impact on the judges who are considering these cases right now, or on the Supreme Court here, who will hear those arguments coming up in February.
Gilman, you get great brain exercise puzzling through these stories. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thanks for asking me.
That's WPR reporter Gilman Halstead.
Coming up, we'll find out why the end of the year is the top season for trash in the United States. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up, we'll hear about how the trolls in Mount Horeb inspire a fantasy author.
But first, you've unwrapped all your gifts, you're ready to take down the tree, you've eaten a million sweets, but do you ever wonder what happens to all the trash that all this creates?
Our guest wondered that too, and in fact, she wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal called "The Last Christmas Present, Lots of Trash." Our guest is Serena Ung, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. And Serena, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
It is good to have you here. And I have to say, is this development or this idea that we generate all this trash around the holidays, is that a new phenomenon that you're aware of, or is this something that has been building up over the course of time?
It's been building up for some time. In the course of my reporting, you know, we asked the question, how much more trash do, you know, people produce? And the answer was pretty similar, whether it came from, you know, recycling companies or sanitation workers and, you know, even environmental groups. People produce, you know, up to 25% or sometimes more trash during the holidays, especially after Christmas and New Year's, because of all the partying that people do.
So lots of wine bottles, lots of food containers of one kind or another, and lots of present wrapping.
Yeah, gift wrap, Christmas trees, chicken bones. What was also interesting, you know, was that people throw out a lot of things like furniture, clothes, toys, electrical appliances. Just this morning, I was walking to the subway from my building, and I walked past like a vacuum cleaner and a stroller, that were on the curb waiting to be picked up with the trash.
So something tells me somebody got a new vacuum cleaner and a new stroller for Christmas, and the old ones just wound up on the curb, right?
Yes. So, people tend to, throw out, the old stuff when they get something new. And the sanitation workers have to pick it up and, put it into, the garbage truck, whether it's a sofa or a TV, everything goes into the truck.
So, yeah, what are some of the other implications of that? Increased work on for sanitation workers. What else?
Yeah, so increased work on them. It's also a lot more waste that goes into landfills, everything from just even boxes that things that can be recycled also tend to be thrown out with the trash a lot of times. And, it does create more work for the people who have to pick them up. And sometimes their trucks fill up very quickly. They have to go to the landfills, more often. And it's just a lot more waste that people produce during this time.
Do you get the sense that people are maybe a little lazier around the holiday season when it comes to properly disposing of materials? I mean, we have wine bottles and wrapping and boxes throughout the year. Is it just the volume, you think, or we just sort of say, well, it's not that hard, let's just toss it over here?
The volume is part of it. When people have a lot of stuff that, a lot of new stuff, or they buy a lot of things over Christmas, or they get a lot of gifts, they have to make space for the new things. So, the easy way is to throw them out, even though, there are obviously other ways to dispose of certain items. Or you can try and give them away, right? If they're toys or, even old furniture, someone might want to use it, even if it's old and, you know, a bit worn. They might be able to salvage it.
You know, one of the things that has changed in the last couple of years in terms of the holidays and solid waste, I think, is the whole idea of shopping online. You know, you order a CD or a book or whatever it might be, and it comes and your little tiny thing is there in the middle, and there's a whole bunch of peanuts around it and then a big box around that. And you start timing that up by everything you buy, and all of a sudden you've got a whole bunch of boxes and things in the house.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot of boxes. I went to a recycling plant in New Jersey a week before Christmas, and I was, like, struck by how many boxes there were. You know, they had a mound of paper, and about half of it, or even more than half, were, like, just boxes. And you could see all the stores that people were shopping from Walmart to Macy's and Amazon. You know, all of that can be recycled, which is great. However, you know, what one of the managers of the plant told me was that people sometimes leave the pellets and the plastic bags, you know, those air-filled pockets, they leave them in the boxes, and you know, it gets mixed in with the paper, and they have to, you know, manually take it out. And even though those, you know, packing materials, they technically can be recycled, but in practice, many of them are not recycled because, you know, you have to collect a lot of it in order to, you know, make it economical for the company to recycle it. So at least this company I went to, they said they just sort it and then they throw it out. So the plastic goes to a landfill, they recycle the boxes. So that was kind of, you know, kind of insightful for me to see where everyone's trash goes.
And I think it's kind of confusing for people, too, because a lot of those pellets and airbags and so forth have a recycling symbol on it. But as you say, it really depends on the local recycler, the local government entity, as to whether they'll actually take it. So you've got to do some homework on your end.
Exactly. So it's not that straightforward. You know, I buy a lot of stuff online, too, because I'm a busy mom, you know, and I do see those labels. You can recycle them. I was really surprised to hear that they don't recycle it. The reason is because they are very light, you know, little plastic bags and pallets. You have to collect a huge amount of them, you know, before a company can actually make money reselling the material. So that's why they throw it out.
So is this a trend that you see continuing as you look at kind of where we've been and where we might be going, that the holiday season will continue to be a big trash generator?
Yeah, I do see that, and you know, even though I think companies are trying to do what they can to reduce packaging, in the past when you ordered, let's say, one book, it might come in like a fairly big box, but now if you order like a single book, it comes in a box that's pretty much just a little bit bigger than the size of the book. So, you know, I feel like companies are trying to do their part to reduce the amount of materials they use. And I think hopefully as people get more used to online shopping, they will realize that they can actually, you know, be a bit more environmentally friendly if they buy more things per, you know, put more things in their shopping cart and buy more things at one time instead of ordering like one thing from one website and, you know, another thing from another website and, you know, having three or four different packages shipped to you from different websites.
So what do you hope people take away from your article?
I hope they just get a bit more aware that, you know, that people do produce a lot of waste during the holidays. And, you know, there's this mantra that everyone's heard before, reduce, reuse, and recycle. And it's something that we should all think about. Like, the first thing to do is try and reduce whatever you consume. And, you know, whatever you can reuse, you should reuse. Like, you know, instead of throwing away a toy, like, try and donate it. You know, gift wrap can be sometimes reused. Your ribbons can be kept and reused for a new gift. And then, you know, to the extent you can, try and recycle. You know, try not to throw it out with the trash if you can recycle, you know, your bottles or your boxes. I know it's a hassle for some people because they may not have recycling pickups. You know, but to the extent they can, I think every bit helps.
But old habits die hard. Is this something you think is worth a follow-up in a year or two on your part?
Yeah, I definitely would like to keep tabs on it. I'm also, you know, one thing that people don't realize, too, is a lot of the, you know, when we send stuff for recycling, a lot of it actually ends up being exported to countries like China, or, where it's used in manufacturing there. So, you know, the waste that you throw away here in the U.S. may end up in another country, and someone has to, you know, clean it and sort it and, you know, reprocess it. It doesn't just magically, you know, reappear as like a milk bottle or like a new box.
All right, lots to think about. Serena, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Serena Ng has been with us. She is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
Up next, we'll talk to an author who finds inspiration in the trolls in Mount Horeb. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Moving to a new place means finding the grocery store or the post office and getting to know new neighbors.
It can also mean learning new folk tales. In today's Wisconsin Life, writer Alex Bledsoe tells us about the creatures he encountered after moving to Wisconsin.
I grew up in a small town in West Tennessee. And when I say small, I mean it. 300 people, 200 of whom were related to me in one way or the other. The place wasn't in any way notable. The closest thing was a town 5 miles away that celebrated the strawberry every spring with a festival and parade. Being allergic to strawberries meant it was never my favorite holiday. Now, I live in a town famous for trolls. Not the internet kind, the folklore kind. You can find them all over town, carved out of wood by local artist Michael Feeney. The town, well, technically it's a village, embraces them to the point that they have maps of the Trollway for tourists that show you where all the trolls are located. Although I'm from West Tennessee, my father's family came from Appalachia, descended from the Scotch-Irish settlers that moved there back in colonial times. To this day, if you go to Jonesboro, Tennessee for the National Storytelling Festival, which you should because it's cool, you'll find Bledsoes thick on the ground. So my background of fairy tales was the typical English Celtic stuff mixed liberally, irony intended, with stories from the Bible. My new home, though, in Mount Horeb, was settled by Norwegians 150 years ago, and that Scandinavian influence is still, to reuse a term, thick on the ground. The trolls are only one of the town's folkloric creatures. Nordic dragons line the tops of the Chamber of Commerce building and the restored train station depot. The dragons have long tongues and protuberances that look like mustaches drooping from the sides of their mouths. It's not hard to envision them as figureheads on Viking ships. Once, out of curiosity, I tracked down these dragons to Little Norway, where the Norwegian house and exhibit from the 1893 World's Fair has been relocated. Identical dragons line the roof and eaves of the house, and the owner, Scott Winner, kindly showed me the wooden template he used to replace the old dragons when the Wisconsin weather got the better of them. That same template had once been loaned to the local high school shop class to make the dragons you can now see in town. And that's something I adore about this place and its people, that pride in their myths and folklore. As a fantasy writer, I trade in that sort of thing. And to live among people who don't look down at it is marvelous. In my Tennessee hometown, I was always considered weird and strange. But here among the trolls and dragons, I'm welcome.
Alex Bledsoe is the author of many books, including the Eddie LaCrosse novels and Wisp of a Thing, part of the TUFA series.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org and find us on Facebook.
Here to tell us more about fitting in here in Wisconsin and his writing is Alex Bledsoe. Alex, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you feel like you fit in Mount Horeb. Tell us a little more about what it was like for a Tennessee Bledsoe to find his home in Mount Horeb.
Well, as you can imagine, the first thing to get used to was the weather, which is almost the complete opposite of what I grew up with in the South.
Especially today.
Yeah, I mean, we had really long summers and really short winters, so everything's backwards here, which means that I immediately put on about 15 pounds after moving up here. I also blame the beer and the cheese for that. Everything else, though, is really kind of similar. I mean, small towns are a lot alike, you know, wherever you go. And everybody here just really, really welcomed me. We immediately, you know, bonded with our neighbors, my kids. There's lots of kids in our neighborhood, so the kids have lots of people to play with. And there's a bookstore here in town that's kind enough to keep all my books in stock. So that's reassuring, if nothing else. And it's just been a wonderful thing.
Let's talk about the life of a fantasy writer. And actually, let's start talking about what it is that you write. You describe yourself as someone who writes fantasy. And for those who might not be familiar with that genre, tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I write, there's two different approaches to fantasy. One is the what they call high fantasy, the castles and dragons and swords and things like that. And I do write about those. My Eddie LaCrosse books are set in that kind of world.
I also write a series about a race of Irish fairies who have ended up in Appalachia during in the modern day, and they kind of blend in with everybody else there, and they play country music, and that's another kind of fantasy. You hear about that, you know. It's kind of like urban fantasy, except it's rural fantasy the way I do it.
So tell me about being a writer and being attracted to fantasy. I mean, you could write about anything. Why this?
Well, I think that kind of goes back to being the odd kid living in the small town. You get drawn into things like the fantasy and science fiction genres because they allow you to have kind of a way out. You can have kind of an inner life that's different from your exterior life. So you like reading about that stuff. And then when you realize you want to write, that's naturally what you gravitate toward writing.
You mentioned how your Appalachian heritage influenced at least some of your work. Is Wisconsin starting to creep in at all?
Well, I got to live here a little bit longer, I think, before I'm going to be brave enough to set something in Wisconsin. But yeah, I mean, I'm absorbing things all the time. The irony is, in my first Eddie LaCrosse book, I used Wisconsin town names for the towns in his world because some of them were sounded a little strange and a little otherworldly. And then at the time, I was living in Tennessee with no idea that I would ever actually be living in Wisconsin. So there's a little irony in that.
And the great thing about a lot of Wisconsin names is they're difficult to pronounce and they look very exotic, even though they may not be so much.
I got to ask, do you remember which town names you used as fantasy settings?
My favorite is Poisippi.
Oh, yeah.
I still, you know, I saw that and I didn't believe that was an actual town name, which is no insult to the people of Poisippi, who I'm sure are wonderful people. But from somebody who's not from the area and not familiar with the heritage of the name, it looks, you know, it jumps right out at you.
And you've got a new book coming out on January 14th, part of the Eddie LaCrosse series. And the first question I have is LaCrosse named after the town or the game?
I have been nursing that character since I was a senior in high school, and I don't honestly remember how I came up with that last name for him.
So tell me a little bit about Eddie LaCrosse and a little bit about the new book.
Sure. The Eddie LaCrosse series is a high fantasy, like I said, series, but it's written like it was a 40s detective novel. So Eddie is what in that world is called a sword jockey, which is basically a private eye. And in this new book, it starts with him as a much younger man rescuing a baby from being mauled by a bear and making sure that she's safely situated before he leaves. And then 16 years later, he ends up back in the same part of the world and has to once again rescue her from things that were never quite resolved earlier.
And since this is kind of a hard-boiled detective thing, do we get some, you know, Dashiell Hammett, San Francisco street slang mixed in with the high fantasy?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
So tell us a little bit about the plot of the new book, which is called He Drank and Saw the Spider.
Well, that's the plot I was just telling you about. It uses a lot of references from Shakespeare. I try to make all of the Eddie LaCrosse books have one core element. Like, I've got a book that's based around Arthurian legends and one book that's based around the ideas of dragons. And this one is based around just pulling odds and ends that I really like from the works of Shakespeare and kind of throwing them into a pile and seeing what happens.
So sometimes writers are solitary creatures. Sometimes I know they gather in packs at workshops and things like that. What do you, assuming maybe you're a little of the latter, what do you think of the writing scene in Wisconsin as compared to Tennessee?
Oh, it's wonderful here. And I'll tell you how different it is. When I was going to send my first novel back to my publisher after going through the edits and everything, I took it into the UPS store. And there was this beautiful girl behind the counter, and I put my envelope down on the counter, and I said, "Yes, I'm here to send my novel back to my publisher." And she, without even batting an eye, said, "Oh, you're the third one today."
So that didn't happen so much in Tennessee.
No, not so much. Not so much.
So I understand also that you're just finishing a collaboration with another writer, and
right.
I saw a little bit of that online. How is it collaborating with somebody else?
Well, I was leery of that, and this was the first time I'd ever done it, but it turned out to be actually very painless. It's It's a novel called Sword Sisters, and it's a prequel novel to the film Legend of the Red Reaper, which will come out this coming summer. And that's a, it's another high fantasy type thing, but it's a very, it has a very feminist angle to it. And the writer, director, producer, and star of the film is somebody that I've been friends with for a while. And when she talked about wanting to write a prequel novel, I thought I'd probably never get a better chance to see if I could actually make that kind of relationship work or not. And I was anticipating butting heads over, you know, being in somebody else's world and having disagreements, and not to mention writing the book in first person from a 16-year-old girl's perspective. But it turned out to be a breeze. We had no serious disagreements. We finished it in record time, and it's come out. It's out, available now, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Alex, we love getting book recommendations for our listeners on this show. If somebody came to you and said, Alex, I'm interested in checking out this fantasy thing, but I don't know much about it. I don't know where to start. Could you give a couple authors or titles that they should seek out?
Well, there's another Wisconsin fantasy author named Kelly McCullough, who has a couple of fantasy series. One, you know, some tend toward science fiction, some tend toward more high fantasy, but I would highly recommend his stuff. There's a wonderful writer named Ekaterina Sedia, who has written probably four or five novels. She's originally Russian, but she lives here and she writes in English. And much like the Norwegian influence here, her influence is all from Russia, and all of the fantasy tropes that she brings in are things that a lot of Westerners have never encountered.
Is that fun, mining these different maybe ethnic heritage types of legends and fantasies to come up with something that's maybe surprising and new to those of us who have maybe just read some Lord of the Rings and whatnot?
Oh, yeah. That's part of the big fun of it, the research.
And what's your take today on sort of publishing and books in general? Are people still reading? Are they still reading what you're writing?
Yes, they are still reading, and I certainly hope they're still reading what I write.
That's part of the plan, anyway.
Yeah, the rise of the e-book and the rise of self-publishing are variables that you can't really account for, and you can't really adjust your own approach to things based on that, because I work with what's called traditional publishing, and I'm quite happy with that. And as long as I can do that, I'll keep doing it. I think e-books are fine. I don't care how people read what I write. If they want to, read an e-book, listen to the audiobook, all of that is fine. Self-publishing, I think, is kind of reached a saturation point where I think the consumer, the readers, are starting to see that you got to pay a little more attention to where the books come from, or you're not going to be very happy with what you get.
And Alex, can we expect to see a novel about a beer-guzzling troll coming out of Mount Horeb in a couple years?
Well, now that might happen, yeah, since you put me on the spot, yeah.
As long as he's a beer-guzzling, cheese-eating troll.
Then exactly.
Well, we have the brew pub, the Grumpy Troll, here in town.
We were just talking about that a few minutes ago, yeah.
And they serve cheese.
They do.
Well, Alex, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been great.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
That with author Alex Bledsoe, and we've been talking about his latest book, He Drank and Saw the Spider, which comes out on January 14th.
Coming up next, we'll talk about the best songs of the last year. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.